First, a few words about St. Thomas Aquinas, because his feast is so important in the history of the Church and Christianity, for that matter, that I think I would be remiss in ignoring this saint. How much people like him, like St. Thomas, belies the notion, the idea that these pseudo-sophisticates of our society hold, that, as I told you, this one individual, this radio talk show host, said that all religious people are stupid. Those are his exact words. Religious people are stupid. And as I told the people a few days ago, this remark is so idiotic, so foolish, the only thing that you can do, apart from giving arguments that need not be said, because to give dignity to that kind of a remark is to insult the truth that is so evident. I'm thinking, as I told you, of the great scholars of the Church, the Church has produced, and I'm not speaking only about the theological speculations and insights, not only about the doctors or the teachers of the Church. We call them doctors because of the word docere, to teach, see? And I'm thinking of these wonderful minds. I mentioned St. Augustine, St. Gregory Nazianzen, St. John Chrysostom, the Cappadocian Fathers. Later on, of course, not only the Greek and Latin Fathers of the Church, St. Ambrose, and so on, and St. Jerome, who was a master of languages that to this day nobody denies that the most accurate and the most authentic translation of the scriptures come from him, not only because of his sanctity, which of course is a given, but his mastery of archaeology, of philology, of foreign languages. He's just an astounding man. Yugoslav, incidentally, Dalmatian. And in later years, I mean, there's John Duns Scotus, Scotus Origina, Hugh of Saint-Cher, there's just... And then, of course, there is the great, which we're reminded of, St. Albert the Great, the teacher of St. Thomas. St. Albert the Great was a multiple scientist. He was a botanist, he was an expert, and this is all by his own private research, in animal and farm husbandry. He studied the stars. He was everything. He was the universal man. Just this one person, St. Albert the Great. He is unsurpassed in his learning. It took him 400 years to get canonized, but nevertheless, he was just a very, very great scholar. His stories are remarkable, particularly what happened at the end of his life, which we'll ignore right now. And then, of course, there is St. Thomas Aquinas. I am not going to give his biography because I have other things to tell you this morning. I can't do that, but I would like to. But he died in the middle of the 13th century. He was considered in his time, again, because of his learning, because of his insight into, forget theology at the moment, philosophy. The Greek originals of the philosophers had not yet penetrated back into Europe because of the invasions of the Gothic nations of the north. And that includes the Lombards, which, of course, he was the descendant of. He was the descendant of one of those people, the Lombards, that settled in what is called today Lombardia, or the place where the Lombards. In fact, St. Gregory the Great was always afraid of the Lombards. They were going to keep making incursions into Italy. Well, St. Thomas was a descendant of these people. They say that's what accounts for his huge frame. He was a very big man. But the Greek writings of Plato, Socrates never wrote anything, Plato, Aristotle, and all of these post-Socratic philosophers had not yet returned to Europe. But we only had translations of them, because at this point, the Greeks came through northern Africa and then entered into Spain through the Straits of Gibraltar centuries later. But St. Thomas nevertheless had access to them in their Latin form. And his understanding of them, he even wrote a critique of the philosophers that he studied, particularly Aristotle, whom he admired, and yet wrote a critique of him. He was just an astounding man in his insights. But it is universally held that his brilliance was not only because of his inherent extraordinary intellect, but of his direction and discipline of mind through his prayer. Everybody holds that the prayer of St. Thomas Aquinas was the key to his penetration of truth, his prayer, particularly his prayer that came from his angelic purity. That's the reason why he is called the angelic doctor, because of his purity of body that was given to him in his early life, I mean early 20s. He was a victim of a tyrannical mother, incidentally, who was bound and determined to get him out of the Dominican friary. She didn't mind if he became a priest. That was all right, because, see, they were noble family, wealthy, and she had, with her husband, sent him to a Benedictine monastery for his early training. He went to the monastery at 5 years old, brought him there, you see, to learn, which was not uncommon. Many times these people, especially the wealthy, would bring, you see, their little boys to the monastery, see, and that was the beginning of schools as we have them today. And with the simple words of the monks, make a man out of them, teach them, see, do something with them. And then when he had reached some level of, went into puberty, he was sent home, see, with given all the basics of education. Well, St. Thomas was one of these boys and spent his time there. And then he was sent home at about 13 years old. And then he was sent to, I think it was Bologna, to study. And there he met the Dominicans and he was sold. And at about 18, and his mother was furious because she thought, well, if he's a Benedictine, he'll become abbot. And he has a brilliant future. Benedictines were Dominicans were mendicants, beggars, and this was out of the question. So consequently, she and her other sons, and some daughters, because he had a number of brothers and sisters, did their best. In fact, at one point, they came to the friary to seize him, to force him, to kidnap him, take him home. And he'd already left, and they hot pursuit, they found him, see, with a prior walking, and they accosted him. And one of his brothers tried to rip the habit off his body. That's how bad it was. And they took him away, carried him off, and he was 2 to 3 years in prison in his mother's own castle. It was terrible. They had a very, very austere life he lived. And then, of course, they tried to tempt him to leave the monastery, the friary. And even, as you know the story, with bringing in one of his brothers, brought in the only sister they allowed to visit him was a sister who was worldly. And she would visit him regularly and with the hope that she would convert him to become a man of the world. Instead, the opposite happened. He converted her, and she became a Benedictine nun and a prioress eventually because of him. Well, they brought this prostitute in to tempt him, and you know the story about he took an iron from the fire and drove her out of the room, see. And with that, his upset and so on, and he was so distraught. Well, in his fatigue, he fell asleep, and then, as you know the story, angels came to him because of his devotion, see, his fidelity to his vows. Huh? And the story is that they took a rope and tied it around his waist as a symbol of his chastity, so tight that he woke up crying with pain, you see. And he said from that moment on, he never experienced the temptation against the flesh for the rest of his life. And it was this purity of body that, well, can I use St. Augustine as an example? He's one of the best psychologists about this field, although modern psychology has also contributed. But St. Augustine was the one who first wrote about it, about the value of purity, you see, for study. It's what psychologists call today sublimation. St. Augustine wrote all about it, because he was a victim of the flesh and himself. And he discovered how helpful is study to overcome the motions of the flesh. And all of that energy of the id, if you want to use the Freudian term, you see, is directed, you see, through, excuse the Freudian term, the superego, you see, applying itself to the higher fields of intellectual pursuit. And St. Augustine was just prolific, you see, prolific in his writings, and St. Thomas as well. Well, anyhow, St. Thomas was just brilliant with his purity of mind and body that gave him, you see, this insight because of angelic nature, see, insight into the truths of nature and of grace. With this, his prayer was so lofty that he was often found in ecstatic prayer, and he prayed frequently before the Blessed Sacrament, and he wrote his best works before the Blessed Sacrament. In fact, he wrote his treatises on the Holy Eucharist and the Redemption right before the Tabernacle, during which time our Lord said to him, "You've written well of me in the sacrament of my body. What is it you want as a reward?" And St. Thomas is known to have said, "You alone, Lord," you see. Well, St. Thomas was so much, let us say, a victim, if you like, of his prayer, that he was seen sometimes raised from the ground. In fact, he stayed from the ground so long that all the other friars were able to come and look at him, watch the spectacle, you see, of his ecstatic prayer. He was also seen to have not only prayed, but prayed with tears, with the petition to come to know the mysteries of faith, do you see, deeply. One of his great qualities as well that marked him as a truly great saint was his modesty and his meekness and humility, that he never was known to be so stubborn in his views that he was not willing, you see, to listen to other people's opinions, and never, ever known to vilify or to humiliate people, you see, in his arguments and disputations, strictly from the point of view of truth. And so meek was he that he was always known to prefer others to himself. And in fact, when he was sent to study under St. Albert the Great, his silence during the class, as opposed to the other students who would often raise their hands and make objections and demand explanations, St. Thomas, you see, was always known to be silent. In fact, it was thought because of that he didn't understand what was being said. And so maybe you heard the story that one time a well-intentioned classmate offered his assistance to St. Thomas as a student to help him understand the lectures. And when he himself found it difficult to explain on one occasion one of the lectures of St. Albert, you see, about understanding what he meant, and he says, "I'm not sure what this means." And then St. Thomas, you see, began to expound. And everybody was amazed, you see, in the study group, if you like, penetration into what the saint was saying. That's why St. Thomas had the reputation of calling the dumb Sicilian ox, that St. Albert said that his bellowing would be heard all over the world someday. Well, anyhow, St. Thomas finally finished his studies and then was sent to teach, and he taught a number of places in Europe, and as well was asked to write opinions and views that the church had adopted, and the whole notion we have today of the way we explain the Holy Eucharist by transubstantiation, it's all from him. His greatest work, apart from the Summa Concordantiles and his commentary on the sentences Peter Lombard and commentaries on the Gospels, his most famous work, which was the last work he wrote, the Summa Theologica. That was written, by the way, as a textbook for seminary students. That's what Summa is. Unfortunately, he never finished it. The last part, what is called the supplement, is taken from the notes of his students. And that's what we call the last part of the Summa. What happened was that toward the end of his life, he, in the celebration of his Mass, something happened to him during which he received some kind of a revelation of something of the essence of God or something about the divine mysteries, you see. And from that Mass and what he learned about the mysteries that he had expounded on so affected him that he never wrote again. We do not know what happened, but it was some mystic experience by virtue of some revelation to him of these truths as they exist in God and his divine essence, that he felt that, well, the way he put it, everything I've written, in fact, he wanted all of his works destroyed. Everything I have written, he said, is as so much straw compared to the truths as they are in God. And so he never wrote anymore. He would preach, he would lecture, but no more writing. He felt it wasn't worthy of the truth as it existed in the Trinity. And so with that, soon thereafter, he became sick with fever, and he died in a Benedictine monastery, incidentally. And it was not for a long time that the Dominicans were able to get his body back, because he was so much loved and so much appreciated. But what I wanted to tell you is, if you want to know, especially, if you want to know something of the mind of St. Thomas Aquinas, or better put, his soul, then I told you in the past, I'm repeating it, you should read his poetry, because he was not only a writer of theological treatises and expositions of things that we study to this day. This day, by the way, is not well liked by the modernists. They do not like St. Thomas. I can't explain to you why at the moment, but he is not popular. Contrary to the way he was always regarded in the church, in the Council of Trent's convening, on the table over before which all the bishops were surrounded in their seats, you see, there were placed three books: the Sacred Scriptures, the writings of the Fathers of the Church, and the Summa Theologica of St. Thomas. And during the reign of Pope Leo XIII, the pope that, in a way, initiated the modern times, he was so enamored by St. Thomas Aquinas that he initiated what they call a revival of the works and the writings of St. Thomas that resulted in what is called neo-scholasticism, and he ordered a re-edition, a republication of the Summa of St. Thomas, commissioned to the Dominicans, that is called today the Leonine edition of the Summa. Very, very famous. Well, if you want to know something, because he writes so objectively, do you see, in this style in which he asks a question, takes the Socratic method, he asks the question then about, you know, is there the Trinity, you see, or does grace exist, something like that, you see. And then he gives all the reasons why there is no Trinity, why we should not believe in the Trinity, do you see. He gives all these, it's what the method of St. Thomas. He gives all the reasons, you see. And you can read them all. And they're very cogent and very convincing, by the way. And then right and smack in the middle, he said, sed contra. Sed contra. Nevertheless, see, on the contrary. And then he states the truth. And then he gives point by point all of the defense of the doctrine. And then he takes all the objections he put out in the beginning and answers every one of them. So he leaves it airtight. Each doctrine like this, airtight. No way. And in fact, so powerful was this method that he devised that Voltaire, one of the greatest enemies of the church, used his method to attack the faith and twisted the words of St. Thomas Aquinas. Even his enemies admired what he did. That's St. Thomas. If you want to know something about what he was felt, what he felt in his soul, as I told you, you should read his poems, his hymns. The Laudato Si. Just open your missal to Corpus Christi, whose office he composed, by the way, considered one of the most beautiful offices and masses of the church, St. Thomas Aquinas' Corpus Christi Mass. And read just the Laudato Si that he composed, all in poetry, as a hymn, and all these what they call strophes or verses, and you'll discover something of his great and beautiful faith and how he expresses it in such touching and poetic terms. St. Thomas Aquinas in the Laudato Si. The Verbum Supernum, a very famous hymn from which we get two hymns that we sing every time we have benediction. O Salutaris and the Tantum Ergo. He composed those. We still sing them to this very day. And of course, everybody knows and loves the Adorate Devote, a hymn directed to the Blessed Sacrament. Those are just a few of the writings of the poetry of St. Thomas. Last of all, I thought you'd like to hear his very last words. Very last words. He knew now that he was dying, and the abbot of the monastery came personally to anoint him. He was on a trip, you see, with some other friars. At this place he stopped, I believe it's called Fossa Nuova, and there he died in Italy. And the abbot himself came and anointed him. And after he anointed him and gave him Holy Communion for the last time, the words that he said, which were, as I said, the last words he ever said, were so valued, the words that came out of his mouth was valued, that a scribe was there copying it all down. And it goes like this. I am receiving thee, price of my soul's salvation. All my studies, my vigils, and my labors have been for love of you. I have taught much and written much of the most sacred body of Jesus Christ. I have taught and written in the faith of Jesus Christ and of the Holy Roman Church, to whose judgment I offer and submit everything. Everything. And those are the last words he said. And they are words that are marked with love and humility. His last request was to submit everything he wrote, everything he said, to the judgment of divine authority in the Catholic, Roman Catholic Church. It's an amazing, amazing man of great humility, modesty, purity, and prayer. Prayer in a way that was almost unparalleled. And that's the story of St. Thomas Aquinas. So let's pray.